Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Last month during our open line, someone called in and suggested that we do a program on the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We said we would look into it, and we did, and we're doing the show, and it's this hour. The center was founded in 2001 on the belief that to improve healthcare quality, patient-provider interaction must improve, and also healthcare systems can either support or impede that partnership. Martha, who's known as Meg Gaines, a law professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says that more than 10 years ago, she learned lessons that would change her life. She learned that her health insurance wouldn't necessarily cover a life-saving treatment for stage 4 ovarian cancer. She learned that even at her lowest points, she needed to be captain of her healthcare team. And she learned that compassion delivered in many forms was one thing that sustained her hope. She learned that her life depended on advocacy. So she developed this center. And it is an advocacy experience to prepare graduate and professional students to help patient-centered practice. Their logo represents a sailboat. They envision advocacy as the vessel and the patient as the captain of the ship. We're very delighted to have Meg with us this hour of the program and to welcome phone calls for her. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Meg Gaines, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Although I'm sure it's a painful time, but you've moved beyond it and created this wonderful organization. But tell me where you were 10 years ago. What was going on? It must have been one heck of a low point in your life.
Well, 10 years ago actually was when I started the center, but my own cancer journey was more like 16 years ago. And it was a very painful and difficult time. I come from a big family, and no one in my family had ever been diagnosed with cancer, so I pretty much thought it was the last thing that would happen to me. And my children were 3 and 1, and in a regular annual exam, I was... Something was palpated on my ovary, and ultimately I wound up with ovarian cancer. There was a surgery where the tumor, which was thought to be a cyst, was burst, and so that spread cells throughout my what's called my peritoneum, or the sort of abdominal cavity. And 4 months later, I wound up with ovarian cancer in my liver, and ultimately was told in January of 95 to go home and think about the quality, not the quantity of my remaining days.
I'm going to put you on hold for just one moment. We need a better phone line because you're very, very soft. So we're going to try and get you on a line where we can hear you because we do need to hear each of these words. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Meg as well. This center has been highly recommended by people who have needed an advocate in the healthcare system. And so it came up in a previous discussion that we were having and then an open line discussion as well. So we're welcoming phone calls for Meg, our phone number and our email address. Feel free to use that form of communication as well is talk@wpr.org. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. Meg Gaines is our guest, director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Please continue, Meg. I just wanted to make sure we could hear every word. There we go.
So I was told to go home and think about the quality, not the quantity of my remaining days. At that time, my children were 3 and 1, and I was pretty determined not to do that. So I went around to a variety of healthcare centers. I sort of became an advocate for my own healthcare, which I had never really thought of being before.
Mm-hmm.
And wound up in Santa Monica, California, with a guy who agreed to operate on my liver, and he did. And here I am. My children are now 20 and
17. Oh my goodness. Oh, that just sort of takes your breath away, that story, doesn't it? And you had to advocate during a time when you were sick. I mean, that takes a lot of strength to advocate.
It does, and I was fortunate to have really good family and friends and, people who would pick up the slack in other ways. But, yes, it is an exhausting time and a frightening time. And, you don't think your best when you're terrified, but you certainly get pretty powerful focus.
Mm-hmm. And you were having problems with insurance. Is that part of the story here, that they were going to cover a surgery for you?
Well, there were several problems with insurance. In those days, I was in an HMO, which did not employ, within its group, did not employ at that time a gynecologic oncologist. And so I didn't even know they existed, even though I was raised in the 60s and 70s and our bodies ourselves and that whole thing. I didn't know that there was such a thing as someone who specialized in cancers of the female reproductive system. And my HMO didn't employ one and didn't really even mention that there was such a thing.
Oh, my goodness.
So my initial surgery was done by a gynecologist, which is not advised for ovarian cancer. And actually, there's a new study that just came out, an article that just came out the 10th, Friday, from a woman called Barbara Goff at the University of Washington in Seattle, once again saying that although many primary care doctors indicate that they would refer a woman with suspected ovarian cancer to a GYN oncologist, that the referral rate's very low. A majority of women diagnosed with ovarian cancer in the United States today do not have surgery done by a gynecologic oncologist, which is just a travesty because the outcomes are better and survival rates are better. So it's still a huge problem in the United States. Now in Madison, three of the four dominant HMOs in this town employ gynecologic oncologists, and you can get automatic access. And women absolutely, I know this is sort of about more than just my cancer, but women absolutely with gynecologic cancer should insist on being seen and treated by gynecologic oncologists.
Mm-hmm. And yet I'm sure that's probably, or maybe I'm mistaken here in a good way, but I'm sure that's not true of rural areas or smaller towns or less progressive towns.
Yes, but most places people can get to, a larger urban area where they can get access to a gynecologic oncologist. You don't necessarily have to have all of your chemo or radiation or all of your treatment done at that center. But you absolutely have to have your surgery done by a gynecologic oncologist. And then, you want a GYN oncologist to sort of work with your oncologist in your town to help facilitate the right treatment and mm-hmm. make good decisions.
The center is, the description I'm reading here, an innovative, unprecedented model to educate professionals serving healthcare consumers who face serious illness. Two questions. What is that model, and what kinds of people are able to make use of the service?
So we provide services to people with life-threatening and serious chronic illnesses. And we do that with a team of supervisors. So we have a staff team here that consists of a physician, nurses, lawyers, an engineer, a social worker. So we have a variety of interdisciplinary. I mean, the model is creative because, A, it's interdisciplinary. And then we have students from all of those disciplines and many more, industrial engineering and counseling psychology and public policy, as well as medicine, law, nursing, pharmacy, social work, and so on. And the students come here and they're educated together in interdisciplinary teams, and they do provide free advocacy services for people around the country. I like to say from Texas to Thailand and Portage to Portugal. And we have helped people in all of those places, so nationally and a little bit internationally, to get the care they need. Basically, we help people sort of absorb three things. We help them, one, absorb the diagnosis and figure out what they want to do about it, and get the care they want and need and that's consistent with their values. Number two, to sort of address financial issues and barriers. So, my HMO won't pay for me to go to this place, or they don't employ a gynecologic oncologist, or, examples such as that.
Mm-hmm.
And the third major area is employment. Since we still have about 52 to 54% of people who are insured in this country insured through their employer, if they get sick and lose their job, they lose their insurance and they lose their access to health care. So we try to help people strategize relationships and conversations with their employers so they don't get fired for being sick.
Mm-hmm. And without being too specific, give me an idea of the kinds of people you've helped. Give me some stories.
Well, people come in with, I mean, I can think of a million things. First of all, people come in just like deer in the headlights, so completely terrified by what they've heard that they're just not in a position to kind of make a decision. And so we need to sort of, I mean, if once you get this diagnosis, you feel like your world has sort of spun out of control and like there are no parameters on it. There are infinite questions and no answers, basically. Mm-hmm. And so what we help people do is to say, come on, come back to Earth here, come back down to this table. There are walls and a ceiling and floor to this situation, and, you know, we can put some parameters on it and help you kind of know what's out there, what's available, what, you know, the parameters of the decisions are, basically. So that's a very common thing for us to do, help people get access to the, you know, if there's no if the doctor says to them there's really no treatment for this, we help them go to places like the National Institutes of Health or, you know, other cancer centers where there are experimental treatments happening, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
People come in sometimes with a shopping bag full of bills that they don't understand. They don't know how to make sense of that. It keeps saying this is not a bill, but they keep getting phone calls from collectors. You know, what's going on? I don't understand. I don't, you know, and they're obviously concerned about it because they don't want to lose their care. And, you know, people in Wisconsin in particular are so incredibly, I mean, if I've learned one thing powerful about people of Wisconsin is they like to pay their bills. Oh, my God, they will pay bills that they don't have to pay. They will say to me, I've never not paid my bills. And I say, look, you know, you have a very serious cancer. Not paying your bills is not the worst thing that can happen to you right now. Boy, do they like to pay their bills.
And, you know, this is the first encouraging conversation I've had about this whole issue, because you do hear so many stories that there is nothing available for you. Sorry, you're just going to have to die from this because, you know, the system isn't very compassionate and the resources are not in place. You're giving people hope that they can find something that may help them.
Well, that and, I mean, cause that's very important, I think. And it's also true that for some people, after an exhaustive search in some, you know, instances with some illnesses, with some stages of a disease after certain treatments and so on, there is nothing left to do curatively. I mean, that's not uncommon. But what you do then is not the same. No matter, first of all, it matters to know that you've done a real search. I've seen lots and lots of people die, and I've faced my own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you it makes a real difference if you have this feeling like, oh, my God, I don't even know what's out there and what was out there and how could I have and could I have this and could I. It makes very much of a difference to you, the person who's got the life-threatening illness, and a huge difference to your family who's going to survive you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to feel like we just didn't know what to do, so we didn't do what we probably could have, should have done, and maybe what if. And, you know, it's a horrible way to end a life. So there is a way to make sure, not number one, that you feel like, yes, you did do everything you could have done, and number two, that you get really good palliative care on your way to the end. I mean, we all know we're going to die. We don't know when and we don't know how, but we all know it's going to happen. So it is in many senses a natural process, but we don't make it a very open and natural process. You know, in our culture, we make it a failure.
Right. And there's also, isn't there, this huge system that you have to navigate. You don't prepare yourself for it before. You don't know you're going to get ovarian cancer or have a heart attack, or you just don't think that's going to happen in your life. And so you're finding yourself having to navigate medical procedures and personnel and where you should go and what the treatments are. It's a huge amount of information to have to take in.
And there are financial incentives at play, which you don't necessarily understand or know about. And I can't tell you how many patients come to me and say, I don't get it. My insurance company will pay for the more expensive treatment, but they won't pay for the less expensive one. And I say, well, that's because you're in a capitated situation, and they've already paid for the more expensive one. So, you know, it looks to you like one's more expensive than the other, but if your insurance company's already paid for, you know, in a capitated way for access to services at this place, it doesn't matter to them how much that costs.
Right. Tell me about the need for your services. How many people want to use your services? Is the need growing?
The need is huge and growing, and we don't and never have advertised. And, you know, we don't put any ads anywhere or, you know, suggest people contact us. And it's all basically word of mouth and brochures in places that we situate carefully to try to get access to people who really need our services.
Mm-hmm. And who are those people? The people who really need
you. You know, it's funny. Sometimes people think, well, you know, maybe you should charge for your services, and some people say, well, you know, maybe you should reserve your services for people who don't have much resources. And the truth is, you know, when you get that diagnosis, whether you're insured or not, whether you have resources or not, you know, you're equally terrified. I mean, people equally don't know how to navigate the healthcare system. I didn't. I mean, I have an education. And I was...
You're a lawyer.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I was as gobsmacked as the next person, you know. And now, I think not having resources and not having insurance adds a tricky layer. But honestly, when you get the diagnosis, it's there's enough tricky layers that I think everyone needs those services.
Yeah. And how do you deal with the money issue? Because it happens, most of us have had a loved one we've had to guide through end-of-life issues or through long illnesses, and you don't know who covers what, even if you are covered for insurance, and you find yourself against a brick wall in certain areas and saying, oh, my gosh, this is going to cost a lot of money, and you already have insurance. For those who don't, how do you deal with that money issue, and what do we need to know about it before we even find ourselves in that situation?
Well, there are... For some things, there are no, quote, solutions, you know what I mean? If it's not covered, if you have insurance and you bought this particular kind of insurance and this particular kind of insurance doesn't cover this particular thing, then the chances are this thing is not going to be an option for you. I mean, at some point, you know, you have to kind of accept what you bought, even if you had no choice in the purchase. That is, your employer bought it, and you couldn't really read it and didn't really understand it and certainly didn't expect to be in this situation. So we don't always... You know, we're not always able to solve the problem. That said, I think there's often more than one way to skin a cat, and we can figure out alternate services or ways to get things, or at least ways to achieve the goals that our clients have, and we can sort of help them do that. And at the very least, as I said before, help them understand why this isn't covered and, you know, what they can do you know, just so they understand that it's not a question of at least this particular person being wrong about their denial
right.
of coverage.
And how do you know all that information? Are you picking everybody's brains in various areas in healthcare and legally? And
yep.
You are.
We pick a lot of people's brains, and we've been doing it for a while. And there are a few, you know, we can read the policies that people have and help them get a hold of it and read it and understand it, and then we. I've collected an awful lot of information over the years about alternate resources, availability of alternate resources, and other ways to get things done. And we have a really strong network with other advocates across this area and the state and even nationally. So we know kind of where the relief possibilities are.
Are you kind of one of a kind, or are there others like you?
We are one of a kind in the sense of we're all one of a kind in a lot of senses, but we certainly are one of a kind in the sense of providing this kind of education, the sort of synergy between education and services. That is that, you know, our model is very much built on the fact that our clients are our students' teachers, and that we as, you know, staff, you know, our role is to sort of facilitate a relationship that becomes this incredible learning experience for students, and then to make sure we, you know, are present in this when we're needed, and that we're able to get back out of the way when the student and the client are, you know, working well together and learning from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're certainly unique in that sense. In terms of free advocacy services for people with life-threatening illnesses, there are very, very, very few. There are some, there's a large national organization that I'm actually on the board of called the Patient Advocate Foundation that does some copay relief and other kind of financial resource relief stuff that's based in Virginia. There's not a lot of free healthcare advocacy services around.
I would imagine not. Meg Gaines is our guest, director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And our phone lines are all busy, but just write the number down or keep it in your head, and we hope to be with you soon. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, starting with Brad. Hi, Brad.
Well, hi there. Excellent program and excellent guest. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Thanks.
Oh, hi. Your last guest, Robert Reich, is a huge advocate of single-payer health care in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be such a benefit for people that are disabled and have chronic illness, because it is so stressful having to make decisions about Medigaps, Medicare supplements, Medicare Advantage plans, Medicare Part D plans, applying for SSDI, applying for LTD from your employer, COBRA choices, what income supports are available, if any. All of that is so overwhelming, and you have to make all these decisions at a time mm-hmm. when you're A, sick, and B, stressed out of your mind.
You sound like a guy who's been through it, Brad.
Yes, mm-hmm. and it is, and even for a highly educated person, it is maddening and disastrous for your health. If we had single-payer health care, you wouldn't have to worry about these stupid HMOs where if you have a difficult-to-diagnose or treat illness and you need to go to Chicago or New York, you could do that with single-payer. Mm. You wouldn't be trapped just going to the Marshfield Clinic or mm-hmm. Frater Clinic. You mm-hmm. know, you could go to the care that you need and not have to be served by incompetent doctors or doctors that don't have the education to adequately treat your illness.
Do you advocate for a health care reform as well, Meg, or not?
We do, actually, because precisely this. You know, for a while we did pretty much direct service advocacy only, and then we sort of realized, oh, goodness, we don't want to only do this one-on-one. We also want to try to influence the system that creates these issues that Brad has so articulately described,
mm-hmm.
And that the stories we gather from our clients are very powerful tools in influencing policy.
Mm-hmm. How are you doing now, Brad?
Oh, all right, but it's very difficult, and especially now with Governor Walker's new budget bill, it's making cuts to family care, Badger care, and senior care here in Wisconsin. And Medicaid here in Wisconsin as well. And it's very, that hasn't gotten a lot of press. The collective bargaining and the cuts to public workers' salaries has gotten a lot of the press. But also part of this bill is cuts to Medicaid and things like that too.
Meg, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Brad and I eat the same breakfast cereal, I think. I have the same issues. My 17-year-old daughter, Brad, you'll be interested to hear, spent the night in the Capitol a few weeks ago and was finally called to testify at 4 a.m. and said, everybody's been talking about the collective bargaining parts of this bill, but I want to talk about Medicaid. My mom had cancer and, you know, we were insured, but what if we hadn't been? And, you know, she was very, you know, she was 1 year old when I was treated, and she still feels, I think, very passionately about it, even though she doesn't for sure remember it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This center is so important because there is so much misinformation from employers, HR departments, Social Security, Medicare, shady insurance agents, and their customer service reps, that there's just so much misinformation out there, too.
Mm-hmm. And horrible insurance policies. I mean, what people sell now for insurance policies are just...
Really?
Oh, God.
Terrible.
You know, $5,000 limit on outpatient cancer.
Oh.
I mean, you can't get one chemo treatment for that, basically, for many, many, many cancers. So, you know, you people really need to be careful when buying these private over-the-counter insurance policies.
Right.
Just awful.
Oh. So just to lighten things for just a moment, what did both of you have for breakfast? I'm wondering if it is the same.
Okay, I didn't eat breakfast.
Brad, what about you?
I haven't either.
You ate the same non-breakfast. Thanks very much, Brad, for your call. And he's absolutely right about all the forms that you need to fill out. And, oh, my gosh, it is just overwhelming.
Yep, it's true.
Sarah is next from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, good morning. Well, a family member just recently had ovarian cancer, and by the time she was diagnosed, it was already really advanced. So she went into the hospital, and so we didn't ever get to the point where we dealt with the insurance, you know, trying to get the right treatment and insurance companies. But what I did deal with sort of 24/7 was running around the hospital advocating for her care in the hospital. And, you know, I tried to be in doctor's faces. I tried to know what she was on, what medication she was on, and why. And there were so many decisions that some of her doctors made that I just thought were stupid. So I would call this other, her gynecological oncologist, who would try to fix it. And despite how hard I tried, the hospital made a double mistake with medication that hastened her death. And I just feel like, what is wrong with our healthcare system? The hospitals can be so stupid. And it was not a bad hospital. It wasn't one of the best hospitals, but it wasn't a bad hospital either. So, I mean, I could... And then I went to the doctor to get checked out, and I'm supposed to have a laparoscopy, but you know what? I don't even want to have it because, well, I don't have health insurance, and I don't even, I mean, like, so what if I have it? I can't get treated, so.
Meg.
Well, I certainly wouldn't, let me start with the end, which is I certainly would not avoid treatment for the money. I mean, we tell people all the time when they come in here and say, well, I don't have insurance, this, and I don't know what to do about that, and I don't want to leave my family with big debt and that kind of thing. And we always say to people, okay, the first rule is get the treatment you need. And it's ultimately, you know, probably cheaper for you and for your family. And there are resources by which we can... you know, deal with debt and get hospitals often do some version of what charity care or community care or whatever. So please don't not get treatment because you can't afford it. Because give us at least a shot at trying to help you be able to get it, and give your hospital a shot. And you know, you sound like you're a pretty darn good advocate yourself. There's no question that healthcare in our country. We pay more by almost double than the next highest country. We spend more per capita on healthcare. We spend close to $9,000 a person per capita in this country per year for healthcare. And the next highest, I think, is Norway or Sweden, maybe, at something like $6,500 per person. And we have, you know, these are facts that are known. We're number 37 on the World Health Organization list of countries. I think we're between Ghana and Costa Rica. We have a huge, very high infant mortality rate. We have, we have the highest error rate by long shot of any country that reports statistics on healthcare. So, yeah, I mean, I would recommend to you if you go on YouTube and Google "escape fire." There's a 9-minute video of a talk given by the current head of CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, a guy called Don Berwick, who started something called the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. It's about a 9-minute video, and it's basically he's giving a talk and describing his wife's experience with the healthcare system. He is a physician. I can't remember if she's a physician or not, but he gives this really impassioned talk about what the experience was like for them. And he's a physician, and he was there 24/7. We have big, big, big problems with healthcare in this country, and I think it comes down to incentives that we really need to incentivize quality care and not volume of care or amount of medication given, or, you know, we need to deal with the sort of profit industry, you know, the profit nature of provision of health care. I mean, personally, like Brad said, I would go even further than to say single payer and say that I think health care is a basic human right and ought to be put in on the same kind of par as firefighting and sewer and garbage collection and public schools and other things that we consider to be basic rights of a civilized culture.
Thank you, Sarah, for the call. Elizabeth in Madison, hi.
Well, I was wondering if Meg could discuss, for example, I'm a nurse who's been working for 30 years, and I would love to learn to be an advocate. what is the process, and is it possible for someone who isn't, like, per se in school, in training, to learn how to do this through your institute? And I would like to take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
So, yes. I mean, what I'd say first to Elizabeth is that there isn't a sort of a national licensure certification, so the education is a little bit, you know, sort of it's a little like cowboy days. There are a lot of people who offer, or a number of people who offer patient advocacy education, but I'd look very closely at what you're getting. We do have a program here at the center, a capstone certificate program for you know, folks that are not what we call non-traditional students, so folks like you who are looking to either change or enhance your career and the work you do with people. We've trained former judges, lots of nurses, former business folks, and they come in and work with our center and do some coursework here. So we have that available. And if you look at our website, which is patientpartnerships.org, you can find information on that.
Steve in Madison, hi.
Good morning and wonderful program. And every regular listener knows that if Kevin McKinney is given a full hour to discuss finance, that this lady or anyone she advocates should be given a full hour, at least monthly, if not weekly, on Wisconsin Public Radio. And I would just ask her if she wants to comment in Isthmus Magazine. This week there's a note of a public notice of a federally funded healthcare consumer advocacy program closed for business by the Walker administration. It was operated through the office of the insurance commissioner, Ted Nickel, and I wonder if she knows of that and if she wants to speak to the closure of that office at all.
What I thought you were talking about was the grant that was sent back to the federal government that was supposed to be administered by ABC for Health, which is another advocacy organization in town that works with families that have young children, and they help them with benefits, you know, sort of get the benefits, answer some questions about what benefits they have or could get access to. And I know that that grant was sent back to the federal government saying, you know, it's okay, we don't need it. There are other advocacy opportunities around here, and that's, of course, absurd because...
It was sent back to the government?
Yeah. Yep. Yes, I assume there's information about that on ABC for Health's website, and I think they're... I can't remember if they're... If you Google ABC for Health, I think it's safetyweb.org or something like that, but if you Google ABC for Health, you can see that. But, yes, it was sent back to the federal government. Mm-hmm. But if it's different from the one you're talking about the Commissioner of Insurance's office, I'm not aware of it.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Steve, for the call. Let's go to Ellen in Greenfield. Hi, Ellen.
Hi there. Hey, I am wondering if you work with people who have no insurance on how to navigate the system. I have, a really striking story between the difference of having insurance and not. On about the 5th or 6th, of last month, my brother and my husband were both diagnosed with non-small cell lung cancer. My brother has no insurance. For 4 months, he'd been going into the emergency room, which is where we're always told that people can go and get treated. First of all, coughing up blood. Now, if any of us were coughing up blood and had insurance, you wouldn't just get it, the coughing, under control and sent home. But that's what happened to him, and he was a 30-year cancer survivor who had had massive radiation. So, of course, anybody who knows about that stuff knows that in 30 years, you can pretty well expect to have lung cancer. He went in about a month later with fluid in his chest, and they drew off about a liter and a half, and they sent him home. He went in about a month later. They drew off a liter and a half and sent him home, and then he went in this last time, 3 liters of fluid, and then they decided we'd better find out what's going on here. They tried to reattach his lung, and they did a biopsy, and he had end-stage lung cancer and lived in 5 days.
Oh.
My husband was diagnosed just the same day. We have insurance. We are also blessed, so blessed, besides having insurance, having our own business and having a daughter and a son-in-law who are ready to step in and take over. So my husband had an intense amount of care taking care of him, starting about the same time as my brother. And finally had this thing diagnosed. He is doing concurrent chemotherapy and radiation for 8 weeks. And, you know, we're probably going to have to fight to get a lot of stuff covered. But the difference in the way they were treated was so, so profound. And when people say it, there's not a lick of difference between the two parties, we're seeing the difference here. My husband is probably going to be okay. My brother didn't have a chance, and he was in agony the whole time. And nobody cared. And people who are opposed to making sure that we have care for everybody would call him a deadbeat because he had been unemployed for 3 years because of an employer who didn't follow OSHA rules and had worked from the time he was 13 until 3 years ago, at which time he was 59 years old. He's not a deadbeat.
Yeah. Meg.
So you've so articulately described the nightmare of being uninsured in this country that I don't even want to try to add anything to that part. What I want to underscore is what you said about that when former President Bush says, oh, come on, people who really need it can get care in this country, you know, they can go to the emergency room. That is, I mean, I'm not sure what he's talking about or what he's thinking about, but that is just very clearly not true. There is a law in this country, EMTALA, Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, is what it stands for. And what that means is if you are, you know, in acute emergent distress and or in labor, an emergency room cannot turn you away. But when you have a cough incident to, you know, and you're coughing up blood and you can still walk around and move around, you absolutely do not have a right to treatment in an emergency room or anywhere else if you're uninsured. So the caller has made very clear, you know, has very clearly described what happens then. But I want to really underscore what you said about, you know, everybody can't get treatment in an emergency room for any for serious conditions. That emergency room treatment requirement is only for crisis, critical care.
Yeah. Thanks, Ellen, for the call. We'll welcome more in a moment. Our guest this hour is Meg Gaines. She is director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. If you'd like to know more about their organization, the web address is altogether patientpartnerships.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour, we'll be looking at Alzheimer's disease. And the second hour, for a good chunk of it, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders will be with us to talk about asking the very wealthy among us to pay more in taxes. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Deborah on the road is next. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I kept hearing Kathleen wishing for stories about individuals been served by the center. And I actually worked with a young woman who was 25 and sort of watched her deteriorate over a couple of weeks and, you know, kept saying, what's going on with you? And she said, I don't know, I'm just very tired. And her insurance didn't kick in for, I don't know, maybe 3 more weeks, I think she was waiting for that period of time to be at work, and then your insurance kicks in. And she said, you know, I'm covered with bruises. And I said, you know, let me see. So she picked up her shirt, and she was just covered with these huge hematomas. I knew she was very sick, and she actually had finally gone to the doctor that day. That evening, she ended up in the hospital. I mean, they were like, don't ride your bike home. Get to the hospital immediately. So I met her there and got her into the hospital. And the fellow, the physician fellow who came in and took all the information, said if she had waited probably a couple more days, she would have died. And so here's a young woman, 25, you know, just starting out, insurance, and she was hit with this devastating disease, you know, potentially very fatal. So I happened to know about the center, and I said, you know, you need to get in touch with this center. And she did. And I'm really sorry. I had dinner with her 2 weeks ago, and that's 7 years later. So without the center, I don't know what would have happened to her. She's debt-free. She's thriving. I think she's getting married. So, these are stories that shouldn't happen. I mean, you know, she should have been able to go to the doctor
the minute that she was diagnosed, you know, felt that sick.
Right.
So
right.
I just want to say thanks to the center, and they need to be, you know, just really lauded for their work.
And thank you for the call. Thank you. Meg.
Well, I remember, of course, this young woman, and I've actually seen her a couple times since then. And she was really, really, really sick, and it was a real privilege to get to be part of her healing team.
Made a huge difference, didn't it? I mean, you keep people alive. There's no better thing to do.
Well, we occasionally get to at least get people access to care in a way that does end up keeping them alive. I mean, I don't fool myself into thinking that I'm actually keeping people alive. But I think, you know, getting access to care or not getting access to care, we have lots of data that that's deadly, and that it's deadly in this country. That, you know, tens of thousands of people, actually hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands maybe, over 100,000 die every year from lack of access to care.
Well, thank you, Deborah, for the call. Gary is next in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I was wondering, for the guest, who or what did pay for your treatments, or are all the bills still outstanding?
For my own treatments?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so partway through my treatment trajectory, I was able to shift. I mean, I work for the state. I work for the university, so I work for the state. So, you know, I'm one of those cushy, lazy state employees. And I was able to shift insurance to an indemnity plan, so out of an HMO plan into a fee-for-service plan. And when I did that, it kicked in January 1st, and then January 9th was when I was told by the physician to go home and think about the quality of the surgeon, quality, not the quantity of my remaining days. And since my insurance, my indemnity insurance, it kicked in January 1, I was able to go all over the country for, I went three places for second opinions, and that's when I found the physician in Santa Monica, and that was covered by my insurance.
Thanks, Gary, very much for the call. Chris in Madison, hi.
Oh, howdy. I wanted to share a billing scam that happened to an elderly friend of mine. She went to a dentist on the west side of Madison, and when she went to pay for it, just right after the her visit there, then they told her they wanted her to pay for it in monthly payments, and then she said no, she wanted to just pay it off right then and there, but they said they couldn't do that. So anyway, she paid like the first month or whatever, and the second, and then her son-in-law looked at these monthly statements and saw that they were charging her interest, and they had opened up a line of credit on her. And so I just wanted to share this, kind of get the word out that there appears to be this kind of scam preying on elderly people.
Are you aware of such scams, Meg?
I haven't heard of that, but, you know, again, I think if you could think of public schools being for-profit or, you know, firefighter services being for-profit, you can imagine that the incentives can get out of hand, and we're horrified in how it can get out of hand with, you know, basic services like healthcare and dental.
Thanks, Chris. Pat in Maribel. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm just calling to thank Meg and all the people at the center for the help they gave us a year and a half ago. And my sister, who had stage 4 breast cancer, moved home from Texas, and another sister and I shared what was basically her hospice care until her death in August of 2008. I cannot say enough for what the center did for our family to buoy us up and get us through those days. It was just amazing. We were fortunate enough to have a student, Molly, who helped us so much. And we are just so grateful for what they did for us.
And Kathleen, here's the part where you have to say that that experience changed Molly's life and her trajectory and her career forever. She's a completely different professional and will be for the gift that family gave her.
Mm.
That's the...
How true.
That's the goosebumps.
Right. Ooh, yeah, I got them.
Really, yeah, me too. I still get them. And, you know, she was an amazing woman and really a remarkable soul and gave so much, and as did Pat and her sisters, gave so much in the process.
Thanks, Pat, so much for your call. James in Watertown. Hi.
Hi. The platitudes are well-deserved, obviously, and should keep coming in, but I think it's stories like these and programs like these that need to be nationally, not advertised, but publicized. And we really, to me, this is a great fault of the super wealthy in the United States not stepping up to do their part. And, you know, when those I listened to Robert Reich earlier, and when you see these very wealthy people literally doing nothing and letting their money, their billions reap billions every year, money they have absolutely no need for whatsoever. And then to hear the stories of poor, middle class, not poor, poor in the sense that they have a crisis, and middle class Americans struggling and listening to the emotion that's going on this. I don't know how people in the Tea Party who are supposedly middle class can continue to think that the wealthy don't owe something back to society that gives them their billions and billions of dollars. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right, James.
Thank you very much.
All right, James. Thanks for the call. Well, take that where you want, Meg. It's...
Well, I think, you know, I think what we need is a rational system where we provide a basic human right, not in a for-profit environment. And I think, I hope that we will get to that. I'm not an expert on the Tea Party movement, and, you know, frankly, this sort of makes me feel old because I kind of think it has a little bit of, you know, I mean, I'm angry, too. I think everybody's angry in their own special way, but I just think that's the way to answer the call here is to get smart and think about supporting the our elected representatives and electing people who want to think about this in an intelligent way. And again, I don't need it to be single payer. It can be, you know, triple payer for all I care. I don't feel particularly allied to one specific, although I prefer single payer, and obviously, but I think the main thing is it has to be universal access. And I think we're ready in this country to get rid of the middleman. Mm-hmm. We don't need a middleman. Insurance providers don't do anything but, you know, move money from one pot to another and assess risk. And the reality is that if you don't run it for profit, you don't need the risk assessed. You just need to, you know, provide smart, quality health care to everyone. And then whatever that, and you know, have the cost conversation in a labor negotiation context, you know.
We just need to, I don't know how the heck we're going to get there, but the caller brings up a great point that we do need to think about what's good for all of us. You know, what's the common good here? And somehow we've lost all of that. I mean, most people hear some of these stories and they say, at least I hope they say, that really touched my heart. That touched me as a human being. Things shouldn't be that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not political. It's just, you know, we're all living this thing together, and we want it to be for us or people in our families that we got care. It shouldn't be controversial, should it?
No, and, you know, one of the first cases I ever had was a guy who had a swelling in his leg that would sort of throb when he exercised, and he didn't, you know, he thought it was kind of weird and it was kind of a lump, but, you know, he didn't have insurance because he was just about to get married, and then when he got married, he was going to go to the doctor, and he got married and went to the doctor and was diagnosed with a sarcoma. They each had two kids from a prior marriage. He was diagnosed with a sarcoma. When he told his doctor said, how long have you been feeling this? And he said, well, for a couple, 2-3 months, but I didn't have insurance, so I didn't come in. So not only what happened was the insurance company actually denied coverage for his treatments because they said it was a pre-existing condition. So he dies, leaving, you know, this wife and four children and, you know, a giant medical debt and, you know, no access to care for, again, you know, these
reasons that are, yeah, I mean, you can say, well, it was his fault, he should never have gone without care. Yeah, he shouldn't, but we don't, you know, we can't have it in this country that we allow that to, you know, that people can just get in this situation where they can't really realistically get care in between because you have to go for a process, buy a policy that's private and only for this many months and that many that. I mean, we just, and then we leave people to the, you know, I don't know how many times people go to the hospital and they tell them that you have a $5,000 limit on your out-of-network care for cancer treatment, and, you know, that won't even cover one treatment. And they say, I didn't know that. I mean, I thought I have health care, and I keep saying to people over and over again, well, let me say to my students, you know, you're not buying health care. You're buying insurance. You're buying a contract, a policy. You have to read it. But nobody in this, I mean, people in this country aren't skilled to read health care policies,
of course,
for heaven's sake.
We have to go. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for being with us.
This is my privilege. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Meg Gaines is director of the Center for Patient Partnerships at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you can go to, it's all one word here, patientpartnerships.org to get more information about her remarkable background and the important work that they are doing. Okay, thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. We're with you tomorrow.